Good morning, everyone. This morning we are in Deuteronomy chapter 21. We are discussing a time in history when the Israelites were in the desert about to enter the promised land, and God is giving them a reminder of the law before they enter the promised land. This is a different season of history, a different dispensation when the people are learning and are under the Mosaic covenant, which is the law of God that he gave to Moses, and now that they're being reminded of in Deuteronomy. We now today live in a new covenant. We live in a different season of history after the death and resurrection of Jesus. And now when we look at things such as this, we learn them because they're the foundation of the Bible, but not everything applies as it did then today because we're under a new agreement, a new covenant with God today. So with that backdrop, let's go ahead and take in Deuteronomy 21. If a slain person is found lying in the open country in the land which the Lord your God gives you to possess, and it is not known who has struck him, and recall that God has developed a system of justice in the Old Testament that was very significant. He did not want to see people breaking the law. He did not want to see crime. He did not want to see murder. And he made the punishment very severe. If a crime or a murder was committed, it was like life for life. And that way there wouldn't be. He's trying to prohibit there from being crime and murder in the country that he's developing with Israel. So in this case, they find someone dead, but they can't determine who did it. So then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance to the cities which are around the slain one. It shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, that is, the elders of that city, shall take a heifer of the herd, which has not been worked and which has not pulled in a yoke. And the elders of the city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests of the sons of Levi, shall come near, for the Lord your God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in the name of the Lord, and every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. All the elders of the city which is nearest to the slain man shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley, and they shall answer and say, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. So he wants the leaders of the city to attest to the fact that they don't know who did it, and go through this ceremonial thing to have, I feel like they have to make an effort in order to ceremonially make up for the death of this man. And if they did know, let's say they did know who did it, they're coming before God and they're making a sacrifice and going through this ceremony claiming they don't know it. So I think God's wanting them to make sure this is indeed an innocent, shouldn't say innocent murder, but an unknown murder, an unknown mystery, and this is how they are to deal with it. If they did know about it, then they are supposed to report what they knew. But this was also a way of them moving on ceremonially before God with what happened. So they shall answer and say, our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive your people Israel, because likely there was a murderer that took place, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel. And the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them, so you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. And this was a way, because they couldn't take out justice on the one who did it, this was a way for them to be made right by God again and to move forward in right in the eyes of the Lord. All right, moving on, verse 10. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, and have a desire for her, and you would take her as your wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house. And she shall shave her head and trim her nails. She shall also remove the clothes of her captivity, and she shall remain in your house and mourn her father and mother a full month. And after that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. It shall be, if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes, but you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not mistreat her because you have humbled her. So in cities where they weren't going to destroy the city, because there were cities that were not part of the land that God was giving them to take over, sometimes they encountered other cities that would come up for war with them, and they did not have to destroy those cities. And sometimes they might meet a woman who was beautiful, and someone was single and didn't have a wife, and he'd be like, boy, I would like to take her as a wife. And God did not want them to have the woman bring in any uncleanness or any of her false gods or anything with her that could bring corrupt worship into the camp. So they would take anything from her that would be of that false worship of her past and give her 30 days to mourn. And if it worked out well, then she'd be his wife. If not, she would be not mistreated, but allowed to go free. Again, here we are in a completely different season of history. Now we have another law. We have laws made by man, and you know, we don't go and take over cities, and it's just, so this is just something from the past that did occur back then, and we are learning of it and what God allowed and did not allow, but it's not something that he's permitting for us to do today. We're not living under this agreement anymore. Now, this is a very interesting one too. Chapter 21 here is kind of challenging, but anyways, in verse 15, it says, if a man has two wives. Now, in the commentary that I'm reading here, it is saying that, you know, let's say you were married once and then you were divorced and you were married again, or you were married once and your wife died and now you married again. They're saying that it's not permitting two wives. The Bible is clear, especially in our covenant today. You're supposed to be the husband of one wife. A man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Doesn't say wives. So there were times in the Old Testament that people had more than one wife, but it's not something that God is endorsing. So it appears that he's saying, we're going to get into the children here. We're going to get into, you know, the firstborn son received special benefit from the father when he passed away. And what if you had a firstborn son of one wife, and you're divorced, and now you have another firstborn son of a second wife? I guess it's not firstborn, but it's firstborn in that marriage. God's saying what needs to be done in order to honor the firstborn, because there could be some confusion there. So let's take a look at this. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons, if the firstborn sons belongs to the unloved, or say previous wife, then it shall be in the day he wills what he has to his sons, he cannot make the son of the loved the firstborn before the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. So basically, you can't choose between your wives, past or current, which one's your firstborn. He's going to say in a moment, the firstborn of the first wife is your firstborn child. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. So obviously, you know, you would say the second wife, or the wife that you're with now, is the loved one, and the other one is unloved. You know, you can love all people, but you're not supposed to have that kind of love relationship with your previous wife. But still, because the firstborn child came from that marriage, the firstborn rights belong to that child. That's what's being said here. If any man who has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not listen to them, Then his father and mother shall seize him and bring him out to the elders of the city at the gateway of his hometown. They shall say to the elders of the city, "This son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Then all the men of his city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel will hear of it and fear. I think that's the important line in that paragraph, that all of Israel will hear of it and fear. I don't know of a time in biblical history that this happened. So God is trying to establish a system where people are not, you know, disobeying their parents. They're not running around roughshod. And imagine if you were raising your kid and you said, "Listen, you know, if you disobey us and people know of it, and if you start acting like a drunkard and a sinner, just running around doing crazy stuff, and you won't even listen to us, do you realize that you could be stoned? The city could stone you for that." Now, what's that going to do? That fear that could come upon someone, they're going to say, "You know what? I better listen and I better obey." So God had a stricter measure of punishment in the Old Testament in order to prevent people from going astray, and in order for them to honor not only the laws of the land, not only to honor God, but also honor their father and their mother. Just to give you an understanding that, you know, we're not under this dispensation today, is take a look at the story of the prodigal son, right? From Luke 15, the son wants his share of the estate, and he goes off and lives in, you know, in really filthy living, prostitutes, feeds the pigs, and then he comes to his senses and decides to come home and confess to his father, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and I've sinned against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But what did the father do? The father welcomed him back home. They had a celebration. They put a ring on his finger and he was welcomed back home. So that's the teaching that the revelation of God, Jesus Christ, gave in the New Testament. So again, we live under a different dispensation now. But God was doing this then, setting it up so that people, he wanted a pure and holy community. He wanted them to multiply a reflection of who he is, instead of having a bunch of disobedient, drunkard children and people not following God in the Old Testament. Verse 22, "If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so you do not defile your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance." That's kind of interesting. So if someone was hung on a tree, they're supposed to be taken down before sunset. Recall in Judaism, Old Testament Judaism in particular, their new day happened at sunset, not at midnight like our days. So a new day was at sunset. So when they hung someone on a tree, they were supposed to get them down off that cross before sunset. Now, in Jesus's day, they did the same thing. They took those two thieves, they broke their legs, made them die quicker, and they pierced Jesus in the side, and they did it before sunset. Now, in that particular case, it was also a Friday, Good Friday, you might recall. So at sunset on Good Friday, it was going to be a Sabbath Saturday, and then they wouldn't really want to deal with the bodies. They weren't going to work that day. So they got the bodies off the cross dead before sunset on Friday night leading into Saturday. So this verse did have some bearing on having Jesus come dead off that cross on Good Friday. Yeah, I think that, you know, what I take from this, and it's really hard to to take all this in and not be there in the context, and not only that, but not see what would have happened if God's ways were followed. What if God's ways in regards to punishment, in regards to murder, in regards to crime, what if his strict policies and harsh treatments of people who did things that were wrong, what if that led to a country that rarely did wrong? What if people lived more rightly by God because they had a proper fear of doing what was wrong? And I guess we'll never know, But I have a feeling, and I think what we should do is trust God, that I think it probably would have worked out a lot better than what we think, because people would not have wanted to entertain crime. So trust God even when you don't understand, because I think sometimes he knows better than we. How about that sometimes, huh? Well, thanks for taking this in. We'll see you at the next chapter. God bless you all.